a library. There'll be books front and center, but there'll also be meeting rooms and conference rooms and courses you can take and computers available to everybody. I mean, it's just an amazing thing.
It's funny, it's scary, it's got magic.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
My name is Catherine Peterson. I'm a youth services librarian and school age specialist at the Hamilton Public Library. The first official public library was opened on September 16, 1890. It was on the north side of Main Street, east of the Centenary Church. But the real forerunners of public libraries were the mechanics institutes. They developed in the 19th century all across Western Europe and North America. And they were started by working people to learn how to read and write. And they actually were preceded by commercial sort of lending libraries by stationers or publishers or editors of local newspapers who had little shops where they had some books that people could borrow for money. Mechanics Institutes started, which were educational institutions as well as lending libraries. And from that grew the public library system all over North America. So it was really in the late 19th century or middle to late 19th century, there was a need for the workforce to be more educated. And that was at the point that public education started becoming an issue for governments and state funding. And so schools began to be funded by the governments locally. And at the same time, the captains of industry, Carnegie, for instance, financed most of the buildings of the first public libraries in North, including our library over on Main Street, was a Carnegie library. You can go all over traveling in North America and you will see libraries that have a look about them, and they're all Carnegie libraries. Carnegie was a major steel baron in the United States, and there was a need for working people in the factories and mills to be more educated in order to do the jobs that were required. So at the same time, working people's organizations began to form to do the same thing, is to educate and to learn. One of the things that's important for people is to get information. And so we are buying subscriptions to electronic databases, and we're making those available in the libraries, but also from home or school if there's a computer there. So all you need is a public library card, and you can access this wide, wide, wide range of information, far more than we could afford to buy if we were buying the magazines. In the fall, we've got a project in our minds about connecting with homeschoolers in the community to see what it is we're doing that's useful to them and what it is we might be able to do that's useful to them. We're working on having ebooks available where you could download a book to your home computer if you had one. DVDs are coming. We're also working in partnership with a lot of community organizations to make their information available online. This isn't what's happening in a downtown community in London, England, which is a very poor downtown community, low literacy rates, 50 languages spoken, incredibly diverse multicultural community with some old, old 19th century library buildings. Sort of out of the way now. They're not where people go now. So there's a project down there that's absolutely phenomenal. They're going to replace each and every one of them, but they're not going to close till the new ones open, with big, bright storefront libraries in areas where people go, so in busy intersections and shopping centers. And they're partnering with lifelong learning organizations so that the library will be a library. There'll be books front and center, but there'll also be meeting rooms and conference rooms and courses you can take and computers available to everybody. I mean, it's just an amazing thing. That's sort of at the, you know, the real visionary state of what might be. In terms of Hamilton, where we go depends a lot with where our community wants us to go. So we work in partnership as much as we can with community organizations. We're working right now with CISO. We're listening and trying to orient and shift the library toward working in these partnerships so the community will tell us what it is they need and where they need it. Libraries of the future are going to be 24/7. They're for people who have computers. I mean, that's one of the issues. So for people who have computers, more and more what's available in the building will be available at their homes or schools via their computers. But for people who don't have computers, we have a very strong commitment to keep the computers accessible here in the library during our open hours so people can use them here. We partner with a lot of organizations on particular projects. For instance, we partnered with a whole range of early childhood educators on the early years funding initiative that the provincial government had. And we work all the time with these groups in order to set up deposit libraries. We have a collection coming into our Kenilworth Library. It's called the Courage Collection, and it specifically relates to the problems of women and children who are in situations where they're alone and facing adversity. First of all, we listen to what people tell us. When you come into the library and you think there's something we need, a particular book or a particular topic, you can fill out a form and leave it with us and we'll go looking for that material. You can also do that from our website. Right at the catalog, there's a point where you can make a recommendation. At this point in time, everything people are recommending is being purchased. I mean, if we run into a budget crunch at some point, they may have to make choices. And often people recommend the same thing. So the children's librarians, for instance, there's five of us, or youth services librarians, because we go beyond, we're through, right through teen years. We also talk with the people who work in all our branches, our 26 branches, Bookmobile, Central Library. So we're constantly in touch, and they're telling us, oh, kids are really looking for this these days or for that these days. So we keep in touch that way. We read all the reviewing journals, magazines, newspapers, which review children's books and make sure that we get them. The catalogs, too, from the publishing companies. We work with specific vendors to purchase our books, and we make sure that they know the kind of material we want. We work out profiles and we work out lists. And we also replace things that fall apart or just can't be used anymore. So we won't let something that, as long as it's in print, we keep trying to get it and keep it in stock if it's something that people want to read. First, on the diverse community representation, we make sure that our suppliers and vendors know that we want material that reflects all the different races and cultures, not just the dominant culture in Canada. And we work with our partners, as I said, to identify what's needed, CISO or settlement houses, public health nurses, school boards, right across the whole spectrum to make sure that we're connecting. We already have print and video collections in many languages for both children and adults. We even have a small Braille collection, although it hasn't been replenished. We're looking now at buying a whole new range of Braille books. There's been sort of a surge in publishing, I understand. Anyhow, we're going to be doing that. We've worked with Parents Helping Parents. It's an organization that, so somebody's been here for a few years from Nigeria, and there are, so that person, that mother or father, can work with newer immigrants from their country to try to get them acclimated. And so we've worked with that group in developing dual language kits for parents and caregivers to use with children. So the and we have it in 14 different languages. So the material is both in the language and then in English, and then there's toys or books with it. So that's really important. That's an initiative that we're really, really excited about. We also have magazines and newspapers from all around the world. The Hindi video collection, I mean, it needs to be bigger. There's 10 and 15 and 20 holds on every Hindi video. We have 300 Hindi videos, and there's never any on the shelf. You know, we just keep putting them in, and they just keep going out. Initially, it was thought the internet would kind of replace the library, and everybody was really, really scared that, oh my gosh, people wouldn't need the library anymore. But we're finding, in a way, it's almost the opposite. There is so much out there, and from so many different sources. Library workers can, in fact, play a very, very important role, and are playing a role in navigating through that for people, in finding the best sites, finding sites that are reliable, making lists for people, showing them how to get there. So we're doing the same thing we did with books. We're buying the books that are most reliable, the books that you can count on, the books that have valid information in them. So we're playing the same kind of role, but on this incredibly vast scale now. It's sort of a shift. Also, because it's all out there for people who don't have computers, we play, and a significant portion of the population doesn't. So we play a really important role there in making sure that that is accessible. So the internet, which was first seen as a threat, in fact, has just shifted the kind of work we do, but we're doing the same kind of work. I think another really major threat to libraries is the lowering level of functional literacy in the community, because at the bottom line, libraries are about words, are about language, are about information, and the fewer people who are literate, who can read and write and function at a certain level, the fewer there are, then the fewer there are people who will use the library. So it's really, that's why the libraries are so committed to literacy studies and to reaching children early when they're first learning. And reading to little children is so important in making sure that somebody's a reader later. The lack of public funding for all sorts of social services is a threat. The library here in Hamilton has been very fortunate in some ways in past years in that the budgets for the library haven't been cut as severely as some other areas in the city government, but there is less and less money for public services.
You are listening to Radio Free School.
Well, my favorite books are from my childhood, Winnie the Pooh and the Oz books, of course, and the early, early Oz books by L. Frank Baum. And I still have all the copies, and my husband, when we got married, he had all the copies too, so it's so exciting. We put them together, and we actually have almost a complete set. I really like Hannah's Suitcase, which is a brand new book that's come out by Karen Levine. Have you heard of this?
No,
oh, it's an amazing book. It's true. This Karen Levine is a CBC radio producer, and she won a documentary award on this particular, and she made it into a children's book. Woman in Tokyo gets a job at a storefront Holocaust museum. She needs some artifacts. She writes to all the Holocaust museums all over the world, send me some artifacts. Bunch of stuff comes, not much, but a suitcase comes. Hannah Brady, age whatever, the German word for orphan on it, painted, big white letters. The kids who come into this museum, who is this Hannah Brady? Tell us who she is. Find out who she is. And this woman actually does. She actually ends up going to Auschwitz, finding the name on the lists, and finding that Hannah Brady, in fact, died in Auschwitz. But she had a brother who turns out to be living in Toronto now. The brother goes to an art exhibit in Cleveland or somewhere, and there's pictures that his sister did at Theresienstadt, which is another camp where artists and musicians gave secret lessons to children. So Karen Levine sort of pulls all this together and writes this amazing book. It's just an amazing book. That's one of my favorites. I really like picture books designed by illustrated by Trina Shard Hyman. I like Robert Munsch. Pierre by Maurice Sendak. Catherine Patterson work, particularly Bridge to Terabithia. I love Dennis Lee. I like Lewis Satcher, Holes, and Frindle. Kids, what are kids reading? They're reading some of those books that I said, but there's a series, Kenneth Opal, the first one's called Silverwing. Very popular. Harry Potter, of course. Harry Potter-like things. So you get Lord of the Rings and Artemis Fowl, which is a teen book. Gordon Corman, pretty popular series. Charlotte's Web. Eric Wilson Mysteries. Survival. It's a series. The series books are really, really popular. A lot of them are written in a very formulaic style, but there's some of them that have some content and some interest level and are written in a way that it's okay. Lemony Snicket is just, it's one terrible thing after another that happens to these kids. And we have long lists of people waiting for these books by this man named Lemony Snicket. Scary stuff. Kids love scary stuff. So anything about ghosts or mummies or vampires or sharks, dinosaurs, jokes and riddles, mysteries. Littler kids like the Arthur chapter books, Franklin, of course, Bob the Builder, TV show related, Pokemon, Digimon, Amelia Bedelia, Junie B. Jones. Captain Underpants is a big thriller for the little kids. That's about it.
Radio Free School. A show by, for, and about home learners.
And I'm talking about Harry Potter. There's 4 books out so far, and there's a 5th one coming out this summer, probably. Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, Harry Potter and, what's that one called? Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, and Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. Those are the 4 that are out. And they're by J.K. Rowling. And I think she lives in England. And, well, my favorite one was the 2nd one. Even though it's, like, being loaned out right now, I only read the 2nd one once, but it was my favorite one. He's a wizard, and he's famous, but when he was a little baby, this Dark Lord rose and killed his parents, but when the Dark Lord tried to kill him, he couldn't. All that was left was a scar on his forehead. And instead of killing Harry, the spell reflected. And so Voldemort lost all his power. But he didn't die, because Harry's mother cast that spell before she died. At the beginning, he's just a baby. And then he goes to be 10, and then he's 11. And he's 11 and 10 in the first book, and in the 2nd book he's 13, and the 4th book he's 14. And he goes to this withered high school place. And, well, so he lives with his uncle and his aunt, and they're muggles, which is non-magic people. And they're not very nice to him. He lives in this cupboard under the stairs, and he can make, like, magic things happen, like, before he even knew that he was a wizard. All of a sudden, he gets this letter, and it's addressed to him. But his aunt and uncle aren't very nice, and they don't let him have it. And they know about that he's a wizard, but they don't like that kind of thing, like, that they think it's terrible, like, they don't, they just hate it. And So when he gets the letter, they get all worried because they don't want him to go to this wizard school where he can learn all this magic. And so they burn the letter, and then the next day he gets 3 more letters. And then they burn all those letters, and then they board up the mailbox, and it was Sunday that day, and they were all happy because there's no post on Sundays. Well, there, the uncle was, and all of a sudden all these letters came down the chimney, like a billion letters. And they burn all those letters, and so they have to leave. They just leave the house. Well, the Dark Lord's, like, trying to get his powers back, but, like, Harry kind of stops him in every book except for the fourth one. In the fourth book, he regains power. The next book's going to be, like, really? But he uses Harry's blood to get the power. And before, he couldn't touch Harry. But now he can touch him because he used the blood to, like, regain his father, to regain himself. But he used the dust from his father's bones to get his body back and stuff like that. It's really weird. He's got 2 friends, Ron and Hermione, and Dumbledore. Dumbledore, the headmaster of the school, he's the only wizard that Lord Voldemort fears. And so Harry's pretty safe with him around. It's funny, it's scary, it's got magic, it keeps me up at night.
Oh, help her if can find her. Oh, love the hill of love ago. Come back again from long death to
Three rings for the elven kings under the sky. 7 for the dwarf lords in their holes of stone. 9 for mortal men doomed to die. 1 for the dark lord upon his dark throne. 1 for Mordor where the shadows lie. 1 ring to rule them all, 1 ring to find them, 1 ring to bring them off, and in the darkness find them, in the land of Mordor where the shadows lie.
You are listening to Radio Free School on CFMU. Book review.
Should We Burn Baba? Essays on Children's Literature and the Power of Stories by Herbert Cole. Ah, good literature. Inspiring, dream-building books. Problem is, most serious children's literature, like adults, pertains to the individualist, the competitor, or the capitalist in us. There are mirrored stories about the amassing of personal wealth and riches, of overcoming personal hardship, and of adventures that further or speak to private success. Missing are the stories, fiction or true, that speak of collective struggles, racial, economical, or social, of activism for social justice and change. Stories that empower more than the one. Stories that do not celebrate wealth, as Herbert Cole says in his provocative book, Should We Burn Baba? Cole ponders on the absence of books that fundamentally question the world as it is and dream it as it might be, noting that resignation, defiance, or the quest for personal success become the only imaginable options unless the young have other sources for generating hope. We need more than what is offered for a world that is in crisis such as ours. The dreams and imaginings of oppressed people must embody the shape of a world free of domination if they are to nurture hope. And literature has a crucial role in designating these dreams and embodying them in stories, Cole says. Often, in the instances when history texts or books do talk about the successes of the minority or racial struggle, the story is still misrepresented, usually in a manner that undermines the strength and intelligence of the organizing parties. Cole makes a case in point in his essay on Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott. Rosa was tired. He supplies his own sample of how it might be more truthfully represented, bringing in suppressed or neglected issues around the central importance of community, solidarity, and organization. Cole believes that children as young as 3 or 4 are capable and should be taught critical analysis. He questions the place of power and wealth in literature, such as Baba the Elephant, his token for what is objectionable in children's literature. This book is racist, colonialist, and sexist in nature, yet it is still considered a classic. Well, should we indeed burn Baba? Cole, in his tactful but direct way, leaves it up to us to take a stance. Either way, we are left shocked and with a deeper understanding of how insidious the influence of an unexamined literature can be. Should We Burn Baba also includes critiques of the public school system in America. Cole is a progressive educator working and teaching within the system, and his essays bring insight into the history of progressive education in the States and some of the people that have worked to humanize the system, if such a thing is possible, which is another story. Here is a challenging and stimulating book for people concerned about literature for the young. The lack of radical children's literature is an issue that can no longer be ignored. Cole extends an invitation to writers to consider this absence and to feel this desperate need by writing stories that challenge the status quo. What should our children read? You'll have a clearer opinion once you read Should We Burn Baba?
Yeah. Radio Free School, big on books, the library. Interview with Catherine Peterson, Youth Services Librarian, Hamilton Public Library. Music, Kolameka from Oakburn by Rhythm Activism from their album More Kick. If You Miss Me from the Back of the Bus by Betty Mae Fikes from Voices of the Civil Rights Movement, Black American Freedom Songs, 1960 to 1966. Review, Should We Burn Babar? Essays on Children's Literature and the Power of Stories by Herbert Cole, reviewed by Beatrice Equa Ikoko. Tech, Beatrice Equa Ikoko.
I'm gonna daub myself with glue, stick some stamps on the top of my head, I'm gonna mail myself to you.
Contact Radio Free School at grassroots@hwcn.org or mail P.O. Box 19, 1280 Main Street West, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, L8S1CO.